This week's episode of War Rocket Ajax is brought to you by Loot Crate. Go to lootcrate.com/warrocketajax and use the coupon code War Rocket Ajax to get $3 off a brand new subscription.
Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
That's War Rocket Ajax to bring back his body.
Everybody, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts, back for 2K17, where we are putting the podcast game in a chokehold. That is my promise. That is my resolution. My name is Chris Sims. With me, as always, my co-host, Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, chokehold? Yes?
Sure. You do a chokehold, and I'll come off the top rope with an axe handle.
We're taking this podcast game to the next level. It starts here. It starts now. We have an amazing show lined up for you. This is our first proper show of 2017, and we have an amazing guest.
Yeah. We have Afua Richardson, who you may know if you've been keeping up with the Black Panther World of Wakanda series that she's been doing the covers for, if you read Genius from Image Comics, if you read the Attack on Titan anthology that had some great artwork from her in there, and she's done a ton more. Those are some of the things we're going to talk about with her in our interview, which is delightful. We get into her many other careers and many other talents. Which are all astonishing, blow you away, amazing.
I will guarantee you, you do not know where this interview is going. Because we sure didn't.
But, Chris, before we get to that amazing interview, we've got some business to take care of. Starting with thanking our newest supporters on Patreon.
That's right, Matt. These are the people who have gone to patreon.com/warrocketajax, and they have kicked in as little as a dollar every month to help us keep the lights on and pay those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills.
Here are our newest supporters. Andrew Kehoe.
Thank you, Andrew.
James Rosario.
Thank you, James.
And Alexandra Anthony.
Thank you, Alexandra.
Those are the people who have gone to patreon.com/warrocketajax and kicked in a few bucks to help us out. We thank them greatly, and we thank all our other Patreon supporters. People who help us out on Patreon get some cool stuff. They get ad-free episodes of the show. They get exclusive patron art that people don't get, that we commission from our artist pals. They get, if you're above a certain level, they get bonus audio. They get line-stepping privileges for Panel President and Every Story Ever, and listener questions, and even physical rewards. I'm in the process of figuring out what I'm going to do for this year's t-shirt. So people at the t-shirt level will get a brand new t-shirt for 2017. You won't see those shirts until much, much later, and only if you find me at a convention. Otherwise, only Patreon backers are going to get those shirts, those War Rocket Ajax t-shirts. The last two that we had, really great shirts. I wear those shirts. And then people ask me, what's that from? And then I say, my own podcast. And then they look at me weird.
And then they say, you're the coolest guy in town.
But you don't have to say it's your own podcast. You could say it's a cool podcast that you like.
It's a podcast that I listen to by these guys who wear their own podcast t-shirts. Because listen, I wear Sailor Business shirts all the time.
But hey, they're beautifully designed shirts. They're so nicely put together. And I'll be looking at the newest one of those very soon. But again, thanks for going to patreon.com/warrocketajax and helping us out if you can. If you cannot help us out, that is okay. We will still put the show on iTunes as always. All right, Chris, now that we have done that, it's time for some checks and wrecks, our first checks and wrecks in some time.
That's right, Matt. Let's do it. So come on and take it, take yourself before you wreck yourself.
Chris, I know that you've got some travel coming up. Is that what you want to check in with?
I have two checks and recs, and they're both pretty big ones. And the first one is that the time has come for Fen to see. This is the week. I am heading down to Tampa, Florida this weekend to get on a cruise ship for the first time ever for a Comic-Con on a cruise ship. I've mentioned on the show before, but this is the Fen to see cruise. All my paperwork's in order. I got a passport. I got a room booking. I am ready to do this. And I am genuinely excited about it. I don't know what it's going to be like. I don't know what is going to happen. If I will enjoy it. If I will just spend the entire time in my stateroom drinking ginger ale and hoping that I feel better. I hope that's not the case. I'm really looking forward to it all. If you haven't heard us talk about it on the show before, this is a new thing they're trying. This is the first year they're doing it. It's the Fen to See Comic-Con Cruise. And it's a four-day cruise from Tampa to Key West to Cozumel and back. And they are having all kinds of... Like, it's literally a con. Like, there's an artist alley on the ship. I'm going to be doing a lot of stuff. I think my first thing is on day two. I am hosting a Batman trivia, a pub quiz. So I had to write 60 questions for Batman trivia. And I do not know how to write Batman trivia, as it turns out. Like, I sent 10 in to be like, am I on the right track here? And the guy who's coordinating the cruise was like, yeah, maybe tone these down a little. You clearly don't understand what is a difficult question about Batman and what is an easy question about Batman.
I contributed to the writing of some of those Batman trivia questions.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
That is the extent of my presence on that boat. And yeah, all I will do.
For some reason, the two of the three most important people in my life hate boats. You and Aiden, not into boats.
Boats are fine. Big cruise ships, not my thing.
I am fascinated by it, so I'm super ready. But yeah, by the end of this trivia writing thing, I was polling friends. Hopefully, there's some good stuff in there. Hopefully, I found the middle ground between like what city does Batman live in, and who were the other three characters who appeared in Poison Ivy's first appearance? What were their names? They didn't appear for the next 40 years after that book. So we'll see what happens. I'm doing that. I'm also going to be, like, almost immediately after that, that ends at 8:45, and then at 9 p.m., I'm going to be moderating a panel with Scott Snyder and Tim Sale about Batman, which should be really fun. I think maybe even I will be Batmaned out by the end of that night. I'm going to be in Artist Alley on day three from 10 to 1 with Clay Mann, Tim Sale, Mark Brooks, and Art Adams. They're rotating creators in for that, so that's kind of cool. And then on day three, I'm going to be doing the Sailor Business live podcast. It's the first live podcast that we've ever done for Sailor Business. And Jordan's not there. And our original guest, we were originally going to have Chrissy Zulu, who's, of course, been on this show before as a guest. But she unfortunately had to drop out of the cruise. So I'm talking to some people. I don't want to get anybody's hopes up, but there will be some of the other people who are on the cruise that I'm talking to about being guests. Hopefully we're going to have a fun time. We're going to watch the Sailor Moon episode that takes place on a cruise ship because I thought that would be appropriate. And then I think there's also a Deadpool panel in there at some point, which is kind of going to be the first time that I'm talking about writing Deadpool. Since I've got the graphic novel coming up this year with me and Chad and the Rob. So that's happening this week. I have no idea on the Monday you're hearing this if you decide, hey, I also want to go on a cruise with Chris. I have no idea if it's all booked up and if you can get onto it. But if you got an extra $1,000 burning a hole in your pocket, I'll see you on the ocean.
Also, because Chris is going to be gone next week, on the cruise, I will have a guest host, and we're lining up guests for the show. So, War Rocket Ajax will continue unabated. I think you guys will like who I lined up to be the guest host, and we're working on getting a cool guest. So, War Rocket Ajax will happen even with Chris on a boat. Chris, maybe we can get you to call in from the boat if you could actually get phone service.
Well, I'll be in Key West on one of those days. Like, day two will be in Key West. So it's in Florida. So I'll at least be able to tell you what my first full day of cruising was like.
From the looks of things, the family ocean view to owner's suite levels of the Fantasy Cruise are still available. If people, now this is as of Thursday night, it may be different by Monday. But as it looks now, there are still berths on the boat available. So
yeah,
if you guys want to get on it, you can get on it.
Let me tell you something, dude. I got that ocean view balcony king bed stateroom. I'm stoked. The other thing that I have to check in with is something that I hinted at last week in the first week of the 2017 Cheerwine Throwdown, which is what I'm calling this year, in which we put the podcast game in a chokehold. And that is that I watched Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice. Matt, I did it. I spent 3 hours watching it.
You're
to finish.
You're a braver man than I am.
Ajax listeners will recall that I said on this show that it would take $750 to get me to see that movie. Someone would have to pay me $500 tax-free, plus $50 for a ticket and snacks, plus $200 to talk about it. That did not happen, unfortunately. What happened was that a podcast called The People v. Batman v. Superman, which is a great podcast name, they go scene by scene through the movie with different guests. They contacted me. They asked me if I'd like to be on. I told them my terms. And they said, okay, what if we don't do that? And what if instead we make a donation to a charity of your choice? And I was like, oh, damn it. You got me. I can't turn that down. So I watched the movie. They made a $75 donation to the Durham Crisis Response Center, which is a charity that Aiden works with. And you'll be hearing a little bit about that later in the show. That, I thought, was a really great thing for them to do. So I sat down with them and talked about BVS:DOJ. And I think I tripled their usual episode length. I was very angry. So I don't want to talk about it all here because I talked about it a lot with them. But check out The People v. Batman v. Superman. You can just type that into your iTunes or your pod catcher of choice. And I think the episode that I'm on went up today. So if you want to load that up after you're done listening to War Rocket Ajax, please do. And they are also encouraging their listeners to see if they can get the other 90% of my fee as donations to charities. So here's hoping they can. Matt, that's it. That's all my checks. What are you checking in with today?
Well, I want to note that the only way I will watch Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice is either by being paid $700 or by being invited on that podcast. So I do have a book coming out that I could promote, and I would go through the difficult time of watching that movie if I had to. My check is, I think we can go ahead and announce this. We signed a piece of paper to say that we're going to be there. For the first time ever for me, and the first time officially for the two of us as War Rocket Ajax, we're going to be at Emerald City Comic Con this year. That is the first weekend in March, because Emerald City Comic Con has a brand new podcast section, and we were asked to be a part of it, which means that we will be doing a live episode of War Rocket Ajax at Emerald City Comic Con. So, if you're going to be at Emerald City Comic Con, or you are in the Seattle area and you are a War Rocket Ajax fan, you better get to Emerald City Comic Con, because you will get to see a live episode of War Rocket Ajax at that convention. I think that's the only time, will be the only time we've ever done a live episode, not at, certainly as a panel that wasn't at Heroes Con, or a live episode period that wasn't at Heroes or San Diego Comic-Con. It's monumental. We'll be hanging out. I'll have supervillain books and all that stuff that I always have at every convention. Chris, I'm sure you'll have lots of stuff at the show at Emerald City. And I'm very pumped about this.
I'm really excited.
Emerald City is the show that everybody says is on par with Heroes Con for being just a great comics-driven convention. And I'm so psyched to be there. A lot of our friends are going to be there this year. I'm interested in getting a guest for our panel, and I'm sure we will do that. We don't know what day the panel is just yet, but I think we'll know quite soon when they're going to schedule the panel for. Yeah, I'm hyped about it. And it's not on a boat. It's on the dry land.
It's super exciting. I went to Emerald City in 2014 around the launch of Downset Fight, and it was an amazing con experience. First time ever that Chad and I had sold out at a con. We had to go like restock from Oni's booth there twice. It was awesome. I'm really looking forward to going back. It's going to be a really fun show, and it's me and Matt. It's the War Rocket Ajax boys.
Yeah, and we're there as officially as War Rocket Ajax.
Yeah, which is awesome because we haven't done a con together as War Rocket Ajax in a long time.
We did a Heroes Con that way. That was the 1 year we did an episode as a panel.
Yeah.
And we're doing it again. I would love to do that more. I hope that this is the start of War Rocket Ajax going and doing live episodes at conventions more, because it's something I would love to do. If you have a comic convention and you want us to come and do a live episode, I'm into it. Let's do more of it in 2017. All right, that's my check. Chris, let's make some recommendations. What do you have to recommend?
My recommendations this week, I've also got two of these. It's going to be, and it's a shocker if you're a longtime listener, Overwatch.
That's right, a first-person shooter, which
yeah.
Chris Sims has long said makes him sick.
Yeah, not like morally, but like it gets my motion sickness real bad. Starting with Doom on the Super NES, I have not been able to play them. But an Ajax listener got Eden Overwatch for Christmas. We talked about that on the Christmas episode. And I watched her play it for a little bit, and it looked fun. And I noticed I was watching her play it and not getting dizzy. So I was like, hey, let me play that a little bit. And it turns out, lo and behold, I can play it. I won't say much about it because it's literally the most popular thing in the world. But I love the character designs. It turns out Blizzard will just like make a game that will change the way people play video games forever, like every 10 years or so. So I really, really love Overwatch and what they've done with it in terms of like fast-paced action. It's not something I've ever been able to experience in a game before, like those kind of, you know, team-based arena shooters. So I've been having a blast with it. If you see me on PlayStation, there's like a 50-50 chance it's me or Aiden. I'm the one who's worse at it. But I'm trying. I'm doing my best. The other recommendation that I have, since Overwatch does not need the help, is just real quick. Jeremy Parrish, who is a former guest on this show and someone whose writing I enjoy a lot, is currently celebrating the 20th anniversary of Castlevania Symphony of the Night by doing a series of articles about the design of that game on usgamer.net. He's done two of them. I think the third one's going to be going up either today or tomorrow as you're listening to this. And they're just focusing on different aspects of Castlevania, like what it meant to make a Castlevania sequel at the time, like what it meant to, like what games it was drawing inspiration from beyond Metroid. I love Symphony of the Night, maybe one of like my top three video games ever made. And reading Jeremy Parrish doing something in the style of his Anatomy of a Game series, which I really, really loved, that he kind of moved away from after he did several of them, is really, really great. So definitely check those out on usgamer.net, and you will have a good time reading about Castlevania, and happy Castlevaniversary to everyone. 20 years. Wow. Matt, what are your recs this week?
I only have one. I have another one in the chamber, but I'm going to hold on to it. My rec is RTJ3, motherfuckers. That's right. It was a Christmas fucking miracle when Run the Jewels released their new album on Christmas Day. It was beautiful. I've been listening to Run the Jewels 3 pretty much nonstop since then. And it has only managed to grow on me since then. Because I remember I listened to it the first time and I was like, this is pretty good. I think Run the Jewels 2 is better. And then the more and more I listened to it, I was like, no, this shit's fucking good. It might be their best album. it's kind of neck and neck with Run the Jewels 2 for me now. It's got a whole, not a whole different sound from Run the Jewels 2, but it's a different kind of approach than Run the Jewels 2. It's longer. The songs are kind of more, they're still aggressive. I wouldn't call them less aggressive, but they're kind of more varied. I'll tell you the two songs that have really stuck out to me and that I kind of have wanted to just play on repeat. One is the fourth track, which is called Call Ticketron. That is hypnotic. I am enthralled by that song. And then the other one is Panther Like a Panther, which goes so fucking hard. It's so good. I said back when the Tribe Called Quest album came out that it was my favorite album of the year, 2016. But Run the Jewels 3 gave it a run for its money. A serious run for its money. At a late date. So if you have not picked it up yet, you should do it. You should listen to that dadgum album. Those are Checks and Recs. Let's talk about some of the comics of the week.
Let's do it.
All right, we're going to kick it off with Motor Crush number 2. We talked about the first issue when it came out. This issue is notable for not necessarily having any race sequences in it.
I think it was Babs Tarr on Twitter who was talking about how the first issue they felt had to really do the lion's share of world building. For the Motor Crush world, which I think we can both agree it did an amazing job of.
Yeah, very, very nicely pulled off.
Yeah. And so with this one, they got to really get into the characters, specifically of Domino Swift and then the new character, Lola Del Carmen, and their relationship and their history with each other. It's so fucking good. Like, it's... This book, I think I wrote this for Comics Alliance, but it's like, for this book to be as good as I wanted it to be from the you know, very simple high concept of, oh, it's Team Batgirl doing a crime story that feels like Speed Racer, the Wachowski Speed Racer. Like, for it to be as good as I want it to be with that log line is astounding, but here it is. And it's the character stuff is really well done. The tension is here. The art is beautiful. Like, I've always loved Babstar's stuff, but like this, I think, is even on another level from Batgirl with the way it's presented. Yeah, and a lot of that is Babs, but a lot of that is.
We talked about it when we talked about issue one. It's as much the pencil art or the finished inked art as it is the colors. And the lettering. The lettering, yes, adds so much to that book.
Yeah.
It's astonishing.
Like, the actual, like, dialogue lettering by Aditya Bidikar, which is fantastic. And then the graphic captions and design by Tom Mueller are just, like, it's a phenomenal book. And I am... Like, it's the kind of book where I read it and I'm like, there's no way this can keep this momentum going. But like, this second issue I thought was even as engaging, and from a character standpoint, maybe even more than the first.
Well, the first issue did that thing where it's like, okay, I'm going into this, it's a racing book, and there might be like a little bit about like racing but seedy underworld. And you know, the thing clicked over my brain when reading issue one, where I was like, oh, wait, no, this is a crime comic. Like, this is a crime comic set in a world of motorcycle racing.
Yeah.
And then issue two hits that crime comic button three times harder.
Yes, yes.
To the point where the stakes of an upcoming race hinge on a bet with a crime boss. And that's...
Over a drug deal gone bad.
Yeah.
Even, like, I talked about Babsar's artwork being even better here. And honestly, I think it's the acting. Like, the facial expressions, the body language. Like, it's just... It's everything firing on all cylinders in this. If you're not reading Motor Crush, you really gotta jump on. Because it's one of the best things going right now.
Up next, I'm going to talk a little bit about Justice League versus Suicide Squad number 4, which came out this week. And I've actually seen a lot of talk about the series on Twitter and other places. So I decided that I needed to catch up with it. And I'll tell you this, it lives up to the promise of a Justice League versus Suicide Squad book a lot better than you might think. A lot better than you might have been trained to think. You know, we've been trained by the New 52 to think that you were going to get a certain thing, right? by something like that. And it's somewhat that, but it's also not that at all. It's a big, dumb action movie, but in all the right ways, where Lobo is just pure Lobo. on numerous occasions, some member of the Justice League will tell Lobo, "You're being controlled by Max Lord to kill Amanda Waller. Like, he's using you." And then he'll just chime in, like Lobo will chime in and say, like, "Nobody can control the main man." And it's fantastic. It's just like classic Lobo. Part of what made me pretty sure that this what series was going to turn out to be maybe more than it had to be is that it's written by Josh Williamson, who is one of our favorites here, who always does good stuff and turns in just a really good big dumb action movie book that is somewhat reminiscent of like 90s DC. There is so much history between these characters, like implied history between these characters. It definitely feels like, you know, this is a version of the DC universe that's been around for more than 5 years. This is a version of the DC universe that's been around for a long, long time, where these characters have built up deep, deep relationships and know each other really well. Where, like, you know, Captain Boomerang and Flash can joke around with each other. You know what I mean? Also, the art by Fernando Passerin, I hope I'm saying his last name correctly, is not so much 90s reminiscent. It's more of a modern DC style. Maybe what I would call the current, like, house DC style, where it kind of looks like Ivan Reis or somebody like that. But it also nails those, like, big, you know, again, big dumb action movie moments where, you know, Katana is fighting and a huge cadre of monsters shows up in the middle of a prison. And, like, there's a big dramatic reveal of Killer Frost and that kind of stuff. Like, there's a giant vault opening that is very, like, big screen and dramatic. Do not get me wrong. This is a dumb comic book. But it is 1,000% intentionally a dumb comic book. Where that is the idea, and that is where they're going with it. And in that sense, it works really well.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to catching up on this. I caught up on Flash over Christmas, too, and it's, like, Williamson is knocking it out on that book. It's really, really entertaining.
All right, to wrap up, Chris, you want to talk a little bit about Jughead number 12.
Yeah, this is a comic. It's by Ryan North and Derek Charm, so it's great. It opens with a Mario Kart pastiche, which is great, and then the premise is that Reggie wins and becomes king for a day, which is the nightmare scenario. And it's just really, really done well. And it looks like it's going to be going into a story where Jughead learns about online privacy, which is because it's a Ryan North comic, which is very, very exciting. And again, it's been a while since we've talked about Jughead, but Jughead super rules. It's awesome.
And that's going to do it for our comic segment.
All right, Matt, before we get into the interview, I think we need to pay a couple bills is what we need to do, because it is that time once again, my friend.
That's right. It's time for us to talk about a great company that goes by the name Loot Crate, because that's its name. when we talk about a loot crate for a particular month, the cutoff date is the 19th of that month. Okay? Which means you have until Thursday to get on the newest loot crate.
While I'm getting on that cruise ship, you need to be getting on that crate. Loot crate, that is.
Yeah. This is Chris's origin of becoming a seafaring child of the ocean. And this is the loot crate that is themed around origins, which is very
appropriate. Matt, can I ask you a question?
Please. I insist.
What is the origin story of Loot Crate?
A group of very inventive, clever people got together and said, what
if... said, the planet's exploding.
That's right.
And we need to fill this crate...
with Earth's best stuff.
Wait, that's a twist in the origin. It was Earth all along?
It was Earth all along.
Okay, so Loot Crate maybe... We gotta pull this back into the range of being okay, Matt. Did Loot Crate maybe come back from the future, please?
Well, no. See, they send out the crate every month in case Earth explodes.
Right, because when Earth explodes, you need your 4 to 6 pop culture items. You need your T-shirt. You need your pin. And maybe you get on Loot Crate DX and get some extra wearables as well.
Yeah, you get loot wear, which is all wearable stuff. But they send all the crates to the subscribers, and then they shoot one into space.
So what you're saying is your money that you are going to spend on Loot Crate every month with your subscription, a subscription that you can get $3 off of if you go to lootcrate.com/WarRocketAjax and use the coupon code WarRocketAjax, you're subsidizing what is essentially the colonization of the galaxy with Earth's finest exclusive pop culture items.
Or at least giving other cultures and races throughout the galaxy our finest items from franchises, including Superman,
like that guy,
origin is iconic. Captain America, another iconic origin. Mario, whose origin is documented in the opening credits to the Super Mario Brothers Super Show.
wait. Is it?
Yeah.
Is it his origin that he swung his arms from side to side?
The animated part, not the live action part. When he's using the plunger in the toilet, and then he gets sucked down the toilet.
I don't think that's canonical, but maybe if you want to learn about Mario's canonical origin, this loot crate is going to shed some new light on the subject.
And the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, who have several different origin stories, one in which Splinter was a human to start with, and one in which he was a rat to start with.
Matt, let me tell you something. You know what their origin involves? You know what you can learn with this loot crate?
What's that? The secret of the ooze?
The secret of the ooze.
And besides all that stuff, as Chris mentioned, you get a T-shirt and a pin. But you can only get this particular information about Earth's origin, or Earth's greatest items. Yeah, let's go with that. Until January 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific time. That's the cutoff time for this month's crate. So if you want to get that crate, hurry to lootcrate.com/WarRocketAjax. Use the coupon code WarRocketAjax and get $3 off that brand new subscription. Now that we have done that, let's talk to Afua Richardson.
Let's do it. So it's a privilege to spit with laws. I'm a reality speaker, forget them cars. I'm learning how to teleport to reach the Mars. When you love this and live this, you spit your bars. I spit a quick barrage. Joining us for the program this week is our very first guest of 2017. It's someone that we've wanted to have on the show for a very long time. She is a phenomenally talented artist, and you will know her work from Black Panther World of Wakanda, probably most recently. Afua Richardson is here. Afua, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You have done so much. incredible, incredible art. I remember the first time that I had ever seen your stuff, I believe, was when we did the Sumter, South Carolina Comic Symposium together.
Oh, my God.
And I had heard of you, but I think that was really the first time that I saw your stuff, and it's absolutely breathtaking.
Thank you so much. I spend many, many hours in my art cave forfeiting social life to pour into my art. So I really appreciate that.
Well, that Sumter Symposium culminated in a big game night that we were all a part of. So hopefully you get to do at least that degree of social stuff every now and again, where you get to go play some games and have fun and not constantly be working on art.
You know, it's not bad. It just goes from one extreme to the next, like almost complete seclusion, you know, sans my husband and cats and the occasional coyote who rummages through our trash, to thousands of people at one time. And then I get my fill and then go back to hiding in the cave. So it's fine.
Is there like a particular thing that you can remember, like when you really started to get serious about doing art and working in comics, that you were like, okay, this thing I do is over. Like, I don't do this thing. Because I remember, like, I follow Marguerite Bennett on Twitter, and she talked about how when she was getting serious about comics writing, she, like, sold all of her game consoles and all of her video games. And I was like, wow, maybe if I did that, I would be as prolific as she is. But I also feel like if I couldn't stop writing and go do something else, I would murder someone.
Yeah, I definitely stopped playing as many video games. That was something that I think sometime in 2006 or 2007, I came to a crossroads where it was like, hey, you could buy a new PlayStation, or you can spend $1,000. That was a really big, you know, it's still kind of a big chunk change on a Cintiq. And, you know, I sat there at that fork for a long period of time, and I was like, you know, if I get the Cintiq, I'll be able to buy PlayStation eventually. But I ended up waiting for about 6 or 7 years before actually getting another game console, because I'll just get lost in it. I'm like, I'm winning here. Don't bother me.
Do you find yourself like gamifying the work, like where you're like, oh, like if I can get to this page or finish the coloring, I can read a book. I can read a chapter of a book that's
I do.
That's not about work.
I absolutely do. I'm like, all right, get these 5 pages in, and you can see some sunlight. That's your reward. Now, it sounds harsh, but I enjoy the work. I enjoy it a great deal, and I set my own schedule, and I'm drawing a lot of my favorite stories and characters from my childhood for a living. So the sacrifice of, you know, going to a club and listening to songs that I don't particularly like, it's fine. It's fine by comparison.
So you said, you know, you give yourself the opportunity to go, like, see the sun. What is your reward to yourself, like, if you complete the amount of work that you have said, okay, if I do this much, then I can reward myself?
I'll go hiking. I'll climb a mountain. I'll go dancing. I really, really like to dance. It's something I kind of just need to do, even not as a reward. It's just a regular thing to do to get away from the table. But
I like that you're like, the things that I have talked about looking forward to are like, I'm going to play a video game or read a book. And you're like, I'm going to go hike or dance. I'm going to experience having a body. Or I'm like, no, please leave my mortal flesh behind.
Well, I know in my case, like, I even have these like very minor rewards that I give myself. Like, I'll get to the end of a paragraph that I'm writing, and I'll be like, now I can get up and walk around for a minute.
It's good to do. You can get submerged in the work.
Yeah.
I'll have all of these Amazon lists, like, yeah, when I finish this, get myself some new sneakers to hike with, or just more art supplies. I'm kind of a paper glutton. Like, I'll run through an art supply store like it's a toy store and smell the paper like a freak. Like, oh, it's kind of ridiculous, but thankfully.
Listen, I've got two crates of notebooks, of pocket-sized notebooks. Literal crates. That I'm just like, I'll write in them one day. I'll have ideas.
You have to get stickers. You have to get little label makers and put it on the side. Like, this book is for this thing. And then you probably just end up scribbling a bunch of notes in it anyway. But
yeah, that's pretty much how it goes.
Well, since you brought up walking around in art stores and like enjoying the sort of tactile presence of art supplies and paper and that kind of stuff, and you also mentioned buying a Cintiq instead of a PlayStation, I guess I have to ask that sort of question for the modern artist about, you know, doing your art directly on a page or mm-hmm. going totally digital, because your art has such a distinctive look to it anyway. Afua, your art has such like vibrant colors, but at the same time, like, that could make me think that it's digitally created, but also it has this sort of almost like brushstrokes look to it that has a kind of appealing analog feel. So I wonder where you land on that.
I look at each of the tools that people use to make art as just that, tools. If you're working digitally, it's just a different kind of paintbrush. And sure, there are a lot of things that you can sort of get away with that you can't with a traditional medium, but I'm not a purist. There were a lot of things that I started doing digitally because I just couldn't afford to do them traditionally. And watercolors started getting expensive. I started off drawing and painting and so on with watercolors. You know, before I was doing art full time, I had all sorts of odd jobs. I was a singer, a musician, a bartender. I was a voice actor, did all sorts of, you know, odd jobs. But whenever I was a receptionist, I would make sure that whatever job I had a computer that had Photoshop installed. And I taught myself how to use it and how to apply the techniques that I learned through some random magazine, you know, on how to use watercolors in Barnes & Noble or what have you. And apply it to Photoshop, because this was, you know, very web 1.0 and not many tutorials online. Now you can just, you know, go anywhere and learn anything on YouTube or Udemy or Coursera, any of these other online platforms. But at the time, I just thought, man, you know, if I have to buy another tube of titanium white, I'm not going to be able to eat this week. So I need to figure out something else. And plus, there's certain colors and things that you just can't get with a traditional medium. I'll actually scan in a lot of my brush strokes and make digital brushes out of, you know, like different textures. I'll paint on top of different types of paper and create digital brushes based on, you know, tangible medium. So I like to blur the lines. I like to keep pushing myself and I don't know. There are some people who are kind of like, well, if you can only draw digitally, then, you know, you can't draw at all. And things are changing so quickly that you can't really confine people to those sorts of boxes. Because, you know, if I go from pencil to ballpoint pen, it's a completely different drawing. And that might not be the case for everybody, but I know that is for me. So I can't really condemn someone else for being stronger digitally than they are, you know, traditionally, because one, there are a lot of different factors. You've got a, you know, piece of paper, and the position of the paper augments your perspective. So if you're drawing on a surface that's flat and not facing you, then yeah, perhaps your perspective will be a little warped if you're not drawing on an easel. You're also dealing with an illuminated screen. So you can zoom in. So there are a lot of things that, you know, you can do digitally that traditionally you can't, but also in the reverse, you get a more of a sense of the composition of a page when you have it right in front of you. There's something that's very grounding about traditional mediums. So I think it's important to strengthen both of those things. And if you're only a traditional artist, that's fine. You know, whatever it is that gets the art out, use it.
There's a lot going on in your art that I really want to talk about. There's one thing in particular that that we talked about a little bit when you were at North Carolina Comic Con. But you just said that you were a voice actress, and that is a thing I did not know, and I need to know everything about it now.
Oh, goodness. It started off with beatboxing in high school.
This story is already the best story we've had on the show ever.
When I was in high school, I joined this all-female hip-hop crew called the Anomalies. They were breakdancers, MCs, B-girls, graffiti artists, and I was the resident beatboxer for the Anomalies in New York. And so we would go to competitions, we would travel around together, and we would, you know, get at all these MC battles. And at one point I battled against a DJ, and, you know, we were kind of going back and forth, like making all these scratching noises. And, you know, it was tied because, you know, he's got machinery and I've just got, you know, my mouth. So, but it was a lot of fun.
I love this woman versus machine story. It's a fable for a modern age.
It's our generation's John Henry.
You guys make me sound awesome. One great story was after one of the gals who was in my crew named Pre the Honey Dark won this MC battle in Manhattan at a club. I don't even know if it's called that anymore, called Tramps, over near like 23rd Street. That KRS-One was hosting and judging. Afterwards, there was a cipher right outside. And so I go over to the circle and, you know, KRS-One speaks the way he rhymes. So he's got this big voice like, yo, you want to come in and rhyme? And I'm like, no, I'm actually going to hold the beat. They're like, yo, a female beatbox artist? And I'm like, yeah. So I'm just going to go ahead and give it a go. But yeah, so I mimicked all sorts of things while I did that. Birds, people, singers. And I eventually became a singer by mimicking different kinds of singers. And I had lots of background singing gigs because I was a flautist for about 20 years. And while I was in high school, my school was adopted by Juilliard. So I spent, you know, half of my time at Juilliard disliking it, actually. It was very, very stuffy and people didn't particularly like music, or maybe I just had bad teachers. I don't want to judge the whole school, but I did not want to become a classical flautist. So I spent a lot of time touring and playing my flute in bands and singing background and eventually touring. And on tour, I got to play with a lot of different musicians, opening up for Parliament Funkadelic, Sheila E. I was on Soul Train, and I eventually went into commercial voice acting, where I would come in and I, you know, get asked to sing like someone else. They're like, hey, can you sing like a, you know, a Jamaican elderly man? Or can you sound like Gwen Stefani meets Fergie? And I'm like, you know what? Yeah, I can do that. So I'd have to, like, you know, scrunch up my face and be like, me and all my girls got nothing to hide. We like the music with the beats when we go for a ride. We like to shake it. So I was selling all sorts of terrible electronics and products that I would never buy in life. But it was fun. It was a lot of fun to sort of twist my voice around and whatever it was that I could do, you know, I did it. Or I'd have to, like, sing, like, Sarah Vaughan or like Anita Baker, like I have one of my ears covered. It's good times.
I'll tell you, you nailed that take.
Thanks.
I have a couple things to say about this. One, thank you for a roller coaster of a story.
That's what my life feels like.
It did not disappoint. There was flautistry in there and a guest appearance from KRS-One.
Who, by the way, you name dropped KRS-One's name, Chris. Just like, oh yeah, Chris, KRS-One.
I don't know him. It would be cool to, but.
Well, I also like that you felt the need to explain to me and Matt what KRS-One's speaking voice is like, as though we have not obsessed over his appearance in the movie Beef.
It was actually news to me. I was just like, oh, you know, because I understand people have a singing voice, and then when they speak, you know, it's kind of part of an act, and or at least their onstage persona is different. But I didn't realize. Just I'm like, oh, you just speak that way. You're not. For me, it's a little different. I not that I change my voice around, but my singing voice is completely different than my speaking voice. So it just didn't occur to me. Or when people get up and, you know, they rhyme or they're freestyling or something, they kind of get into a character a little bit, but not with Chris. This is KRS-One is KRS-One 100% of the time. It's like Wonder Woman. Yes, <it's> there's no secret identity. This is who he is.
Well, I'll just say, certainly no one on this podcast right now has attempted to read the gospel of hip-hop and hear KRS-One's voice in their head. That definitely didn't.
Real quick, and then we can move on. Afua, do you know about the comic that KRS-One did with Kyle Baker?
No, I don't.
Okay, it's... I always like to have a project when I go to cons, like something to hunt down in the dealer room. Mm-hmm. It was called Break the Chain. It came out in the mid-90s I don't think it was the same branch of DC that put out the Prince comics that Dwayne McDuffie mm-hmm. wrote.
Yeah.
But it's definitely not DC, like a DC Bullet comic.
Gotcha.
But it's KRS-One and Kyle Baker doing like a positive message hip-hop themed comic that comes with a cassette tape that you are meant to listen to along with the comic, and you turn the page every time KRS-One says word.
Oh my god, I want to do that now, like in life. Just
yeah, it's I had a copy and I believe it is gone now, but I because nobody knows about it, you can get it for like $4.
What?
Yeah, it's
now
great.
It's gonna be all gone on Amazon. Thanks, it is.
Well, like I said, there was one thing in particular that I really wanted to talk to you about, because you talked about it on a panel that we were on together.
Yes.
At NC Comic Con. You talked about doing the covers for World of Wakanda.
Yes.
And how you incorporated these specific symbols, and I was hoping you could talk to us about that a little bit.
It was really an honor to work on the covers for World of Wakanda. It just seemed like an epic project, and I thought to myself, well, I really want to put a big piece of myself in this, because this is a very monumental creation. We've got some phenomenal writers, you know, the first African-American female writer at Marvel. This is just a really big motion for progress. These are the things that people have been, you know, complaining in the streets about. So I wanted to make sure that I put as much of me and my blood and bones in it as possible. My name, Afua, is a West African name. It's from Ghana. It's for a girl born on Friday. And there are a whole bunch of them. Like Abena is Tuesday. Kwame, I believe, is Sunday. Kweku, I think, is Wednesday, maybe Thursday. Names are very, very important, and symbols are as well. There are these symbols called the Adinkra symbols, and as the legend goes, there was a Ghanaian prince named Kofi, which is the male equivalent of my name, a boy born on Friday. In order to save his people, he had to surrender to the enemy. He wanted to stop a war, and in his sort of death march to the enemy's territory, he had a cloth, a large cloth sewn in with symbols And I believe the word Adinkra means farewell. Each of the symbols sort of contain a philosophy. And I decided to put those symbols sort of embedded within the covers. So the very first cover has a couple of symbols. The one behind Black Panther basically means he who wants to be king must first learn to serve. It kind of looks like an arrow inside a box. It's very dark, so it might be a little difficult to see. Behind Anika and Io, the two star-crossed lovers who are basically fighting a revolution, their sense of duty in order to be together and also do what's right and protect people who've been harmed in the absence of the Black Panther. There is a little symbol of independence, and it basically translates into independence comes with responsibilities, and the symbol is a Fawa Hori. Behind the main antagonist is a symbol, Tambo Bemfrey. The enemy will stew in his own juices, which is a symbol of envy and regret and just sort of the lower base consciousness feelings that this character brings out in people. That's her inhuman ability. So I thought it was very fitting. So hidden throughout, there are a bunch of other ones for each of the covers, a sort of war, symbols of life change and life's dynamics. And I thought it would be a way for me to just place a piece of my lineage in the covers themselves, because, you know, just the fact that Black Panther has his own series written by African-Americans, African-American women, you know, and there's a movie coming out. And also, you know, it's getting a lot of really, really great support. You know, these books don't happen without people backing them. The Black Panther has been around for a long time, but, you know, now it's being recognized that you can have a Black male protagonist and it be a movie for everyone. So I'm just really, really excited about what's being created right now. And that was my way of stamping a little piece of me and a little piece of my history in the work.
I really love the way that they're incorporated, because I loved those covers before you talked about that on the panel. And I realized what those were. They're these really kind of cool tessellated images in the background, and they're, when you first see them, if you don't know the story behind them, like I didn't, they just look like really cool design touches, you know? And then finding out that they have, that there's so much more going on was really just mind-blowing for me to sit on that panel and for you to explain it all. It's really super cool, and I love the way it comes together on all of those covers.
If our listeners want to see those designs and how they are incorporated in the covers, you know, what the actual symbols look like and what they mean, there's an image that you were kind enough to send us, Afua. I'm going to include those in the show notes on warrocketindex.com. So please go check those out, everybody.
Taking a visual idea and like adding this level of challenge to it and this deeper meaning to it. And that's the kind of thing that I really respond to in comics, where you have, you know, you have a thing that already looks cool, and then there's so much more going on than you think on at first glance. Like, it's really awesome.
Thank you. I'm such a glutton for puzzles and multivalent symbols and things sort of working on different levels. And I was like, I have to do this. It's like having a secret identity and hiding it in there. Like, you need a decoder ring and some kind of, you know, 3D glasses to get it. Not really, but
that idea of like hidden messages in artwork, like it, and kind of treating it like a puzzle. Is that something that you've found, like, you know, and you've enjoyed putting into your art before this?
Oh, absolutely. I worked on a series with Top Cow called Genius, I was a bit stressed working on that. But the very, very first cover, I have the main protagonist. I got a lot of heat for that, too, because she's almost nude, but she's sort of wrapped in yellow caution tape, and she's surrounded in a chalk outline like it's a crime scene. And on the lower left-hand side, there is a bee in the corner. And there's a whole bunch of symbolism sort of crammed into one, but a couple of the things that I, you know, put in there was the yellow tape is sort of symbolic of Prometheus. There's a painting of Prometheus wrapped in sort of a yellow, like a golden shroud, and he's stealing fire from the gods. So I have her holding a firearm, because essentially the story is that she is a young woman who's a product of her circumstances. She lives in Los Angeles, and her parents were killed by police, but they were also drug dealers, and so she's put into a foster care system, and she realizes that a lot of the people who are being incarcerated or are suffering from generational poverty are part of this cyclical game. And she's kind of a military strategist. She sees patterns, and she understands the pattern that they're falling into, you know, that they're just this, they're on this wheel, this revolving door in and out of for-profit prisons, and that some of the police are trying and others are just ushering them along to benefit. And so she realizes, like, okay, well, we're fighting each other. They're encouraging us to fight each other. So why don't we stop doing that and take up arms and form our own militia? Not that I encourage that necessarily. You know, there are definitely problems with that as well. But that was sort of her solution. So instead of, you know, Bloods and Crips, or, you know, 8th Street Wops Crips versus, you know, Grape Street fighting each other, she takes the technology of strategy and gives that to her people. So that was one thing. And also I sort of set it up in a cube layout. Basically the elements within it correspond with a geometric allegory for the moon, which is this sort of flyweight for the earth. And the moon is associated with hexagons and bees, because bees, of course, produce honeycombs. Honeycombs are hexagons. Hexagons are the outer structure of a cube. And essentially, they are this swarm, this army, and she's the queen bee. And if you look on the side of Alexander the Great's, there's a relief that Da Vinci had done, there's a bee sort of embedded in the side of it, and Masonically or an occulted symbol of the cube is the bee. And I could go on and on about it, but yeah.
I was literally going to make a joke about how there's a GameCube controller on that cover because she likes
Super Smash Brothers. Yes, there is a GameCube
controller.
That was me also saying, like, damn, I miss playing video games.
Well, I mean, just based on that and the amount of thought that obviously went into the World of Wakanda covers and all the thought that goes into so much of the rest of your art, like, you did a pinup for the Attack on Titan anthology that is both identifiably your art and identifiably enough the style of Attack on Titan. It's this melding of those two styles that is kind of incredible. I have looked at that image for quite some time to study the whole thing, because it's
thank you
it's stunning.
And not all of my images have that much thought in them, obviously. In this case, I just really love Levi. He's so cute. But it's interesting. When I first started, I was very, very influenced by anime and manga. And when I started getting into comics, you know, a lot of my editors were like, "Oh, it's too cartoony. It's too anime." And so I started changing a little bit. So it was nice to kind of, like, you know, shake that off a little bit and be like, "Yeah, you know what? I'm going to do what I want." And get back into my anime roots.
Well, I kind of want to culminate into, like, clearly you put yourself, a lot of yourself into music when you were doing that, where beatboxing turned into doing animal sounds, turned into singing. So I really want to know how that became doing the art you do. Like what's the connective tissue between, you know, when you were singing and doing music and eventually doing the art you do now?
A lot of times I was the only illustrator that any of my musician friends knew personally. So if they needed a flyer for an event, a logo for their artist, an album cover, they would hire me to do it. And they would recommend me personally. So it was something that was a job. And I would, you know, separate my jobs from my passion, so to speak. So I had an alias, and I was pursuing a career in music. I didn't want people to dislike my music because they disliked my art, or like my art because they like my music. I wanted each one of them to stand on their own. I think in 2006, I went on my very first vacation, which was to San Diego Comic-Con. And it was my first time being in California. I was used to speaking to people, so walking up to Mark Silvestri was not very difficult if I had to, you know, go over to LaBelle and speak to them. So I was like, well, you know, the only way you get to know people is to get to know them. And I walked over to the Top Cow booth, and I said, I love your work. I'm not going to freak out. Can I buy something? And Mark just happened to be selling his sketchbook he had just put out. And I just handed him a postcard. I didn't want to, they're there to sell books. I didn't want to burden them with a giant portfolio. And plus, I didn't want to carry it all the way from New York to California. So I just had a little postcard with the best examples of my work on it. I had a little PBase website and said, hey, if you guys ever need any art things, I know you have access to everyone who's awesome in the world, but there's me. And I think 6 months later, I lost my job at the post-production / commercial sound recording facility that I was working at. And I think a couple of months after, I get a call like, hey, would you want to work on this project? And I'm like, oh, thank God. I was almost out of unemployment. It was very sudden. It was just kind of like, okay, you're doing music, you're doing art. I'm like, oh, right now, here we go. But I had been working at it for years. My first publication was actually an erotic comic under an alias, which I won't divulge the name of. It was a quarterly comic that was quite terrible, but everyone's first comic is pretty terrible, so I'll forgive myself. But thanks to Brandon Graham, who just literally walked me into his editor's office and sort of like shook me like, you should do comics full time. I got published, and then after that, the fear was over. And I was like, oh, here's another job I can do. And after that, I was in Ivan Brandon's 24/7 anthology, and then I have just a few covers here and there, a sort of vampire horror comic called Half Dead I did a cover for that got picked up by Marvel, so I inadvertently got a job at Marvel a bajillion years ago. And after Genius came out, everything just exploded. The timing of that was really, really scary too. Like, here I am drawing, you know, gangs and protesters shooting police officers with sniper rifles, and the National Guard rolling tanks on U.S. soil. And it's, what, only a couple of days before the events of the protest in Ferguson, Missouri. So it became a talking piece, say a mantle, to show that, you know, you can have comics and fiction and entertainment that's very politically relevant, because politics and religion are those two things that control our lives, but we're not allowed to talk about it. and then it was just a big shift where everything was a political piece. But I feel very fortunate that I have the opportunity to just even to work on the X-Men cover. That was a dream, because I love the X-Men. Out of all of the comic book teams and, you know, alliances, the X-Men, that's it for me.
Chad and I were so stoked because we didn't know. We didn't know anyone who was doing the variant covers until they were announced. So I was like, oh man, I wonder who's going to do our hip hop variant. God, I hope it's a good one, you know. and then we found out oh, it's Afua. It's going to be amazing. But I've been wanting to ask you forever. How did you was there a list that you could pick from? Did you bring that one to the table? Who picked the album?
Yeah, I don't know who picked the album, but I'm glad they picked that one. They just said, "Okay, this is what you're getting." And I think they asked if there was anyone in particular I wanted to draw, and I was just like, "Oh, please, 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 let me draw the X-Men." And when they were telling me about the album and sort of showed me the layout, I said, okay, who can I draw on this? I said, well, as long as you have, you know, Wolverine and Jubilee, it's, you know, everybody else is fine as long as you stick to the sort of the 90s version of the character. I was like, yes, I'm drawing Storm. Can I give her natural hair? Is that okay? I mean, I love Storm, and I love her mohawks. I love her straight hair. I love her locks. I love all of it. But I've never seen her with a storm cloud. I was like, oh, please. Oh, please. I know it's not in continuity. Please. And it was totally fine. I'm like, oh, yeah. Do what you want.
It looks amazing on that cover. I love the way Storm looks on the cover. And Jubilee, too. It's so great. It's such a great cover.
Thank you.
Anyway. Well, now that my curiosity has been satisfied about this book that we both worked on, I think it is time that our listeners have their curiosity satisfied. I think it's time we turn it over to Twitter questions. Matt,
yay.
If people want to get in the year 2017 on these conversations that we have each and every week, how can they go about that?
Well, I propose that the way to go about that is that we all start a new language. Let's start 2017 with a new communication system, and I propose that communication system is beatboxing. Yes. Certain beatbox tones and sounds will be replacements for words of various types, and that will become the new way we communicate long into the future. Then, once we've created that new beatbox language, start an account on twitter.com where maybe you'll type in that beatbox language. Follow the Matt D. Wilson, that's me, and the ISB, that's Chris. Wait until Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. One of us will put out the call for questions, and then you can ask a question just like the ones you're about to hear for our guest, Afua Richardson. We don't have a ton of time left, so I'm going to try to make these as quick as I can. The first one I'm going to is not a question, Afua, but I wanted to read it out to you. It's okay. From Alex_Chung, who says that he does not have an intelligent question, but just wanted to say that he loves genius.
Aw, thanks, and, Alex.
Had a shout out to Mark Bernard in there.
Yay.
Coltreg on Twitter has this question. It's a War Rocket Ajax classic. He wants to know, what is your favorite type of dinosaur?
My favorite type of dinosaur? I'll say a pterodactyl.
It's a good one. That's a good choice.
Yeah, give me a pterodactyl.
Gotta love this flying dinosaurs. Giant birds.
Yeah. Here's the secret, though. They're all giant birds.
I know. Could you imagine if they had feathers?
Oh,
you know, if they were just giant chickens, not to eat necessarily.
A lot of people don't like the new science that's telling them that dinosaurs had feathers. I think it's the best.
Could you imagine like a T-Rex?
Yes.
With like a just plumage, just crazy, like they don't sound like what we think, like roars or anything. They just balk at.
It's so great. It's so great.
Smaller lizards.
And you know what?
Spit and all that.
If they were birds instead of lizards, instead of reptiles, then it also means they were much more delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Go back and have you some dinosaur. Xavier Files on Twitter has this to ask you, Afua. Mm-hmm. Since you have done some work on Black Panther, they want to know what other Jack Kirby creation you would like to tackle at some point.
Ooh.
Well, I mean, we also talked about you working on X-Men, which would fall into the Jack Kirby category.
I don't know. I'm a big fan of Thor and Loki. Not sure about that one. There's so many. There's so many like really good ones.
I mean, we could take Thor. We could take a general Asgard approach as an answer.
Am I correct in remembering that you dressed as Thor at a con?
Oh, I was with a gal who was dressed as Lady Thor. I want to dress as Thor. I kind of also want to do like a gender swap Doctor Strange. Maybe just because I want to wear a cape. with a high collar for no reason.
I support the cape lifestyle. Like, if enough of us do it, it will come back.
Speaking of other superheroes that you're working on, we didn't talk at all about All-Star Batman, which I'm shocked about.
That's true.
It's we'll have to have you back because I'm sure I'll have thoughts.
Yes.
Well, Afua, before we wrap up, do you want to say anything about All-Star Batman number 9, which is coming up?
Oh goodness. Well, it's going to be a big story. Basically, everything sort of comes to a head at story 9. So I don't know how many beans I can spill, but it will take place in Washington, D.C. So that's all I can give you.
All right. What a wonderful tease. What a wonderful tease to end on.
Hence why Batman is sitting on the Lincoln Memorial Zeus-like throne.
Yeah, he's
there will be war games.
He's sitting Lincoln style up in there. Afua Richardson, it has been an absolute delight and pleasure to talk to you on War Rocket Ajax. Before we let you go, please let all our listeners know how they can find your stuff online.
Hooray! Well, I'm at afuarichardson.com. You can also find me at Facebook. And to spell that out, it's A-F-U-A, very phonetic, Richardson. I'm also on Instagram at DrFoo, DocTaFoo. That's a nickname, a long story for another time.
Well, Afua, I hope you come back and talk to us. This has been seriously one of my favorite interviews that we've ever done, because it's the only interview where KRS-One has made a guest appearance. Thank you so much for talking to us, and I hope we can have you back sometime soon.
Yes, it'll be fun.
Thanks once again to Afua Richardson for joining us. Definitely check out everything she does. It's all really, really phenomenal.
It sure is. And we're going to try to do something phenomenal right now by perfectly answering a listener question. This is a question from someone on Tumblr who asked us this anonymously, but I thought it would generate some good discussion between us, Chris. Their question is, a lot of people I know read Identity Crisis as one of their first comics and enjoyed it. How do you explain why a lot of fans think Identity Crisis is bad and did so much damage to someone without much background in comics?
First of all, the sin is not with them, right?
Right.
Like, the sin is not with you, reader.
It's that somebody gave you Identity Crisis as your first comic. Or recommended it to you as your first comic.
Or you know, it's the fault of a company that told you this was an important story and a best-selling graphic novel that you should read and that there should be a 10th anniversary version of. Your first comics, if you walk into a comic book store, are going to be the comics that are on the wall. And honestly, like, in terms of quality, that can be a crapshoot. Like, we talked to Robert Venditti ages ago about his first comics experience and how he, like, they sold him Watchmen as his first comic, and then he came back and bought Tom Strong because it had the same writer, and then he came back and bought Kingdom Come because it had the cover artist from Tom Strong. Like, not everybody has that. Like, not everybody gets that and then becomes Robert Venditti. Like, sometimes you gotta get through a lot of stuff. And we're in this era where we're, you know, 11 years now removed from Identity Crisis existing as a paperback, as a hardcover, as a, you know, what was a big DC story that they told people to read. So the sin is not with the readers on this one.
I think for some people, Identity Crisis serves that same Watchmen purpose. It's not nearly as good of a story as Watchmen, but it, because I'm gonna make an assumption here. So if I'm wrong about this, forgive me, but I'm gonna assume that quite a few people who would pick up Identity Crisis as their first comic would do so with a working familiarity of who Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, The Flash, Martian Manhunter, the Justice League are, right?
Mm-hmm.
They might not know Ralph and Sue Dibney, but they know who the Justice League are. And I'm going to assume that they had a knowledge of who the Justice League was in that time because of the Justice League cartoon, right?
Yeah. When was Justice League on the air? It had to be 10 years ago, right?
More. It was like early 2000s.
Yeah, so it's I feel like a lot of people who came to Identity Crisis not as comics readers were maybe people who watched Justice League when they were kids and then grew out of it, you know? Because you grow out of everything that you like when you're a kid, unless you're me.
Well, the point I'm making is Justice League served the purpose that a lot of people's first comics serve, which is to give them a baseline standard of what superheroes are, what they stand for, and what they do.
Yeah.
And a sense that generally superheroes are good. And they're good guys who do good things and want to help the world and benefit. You know, there are all kinds of arguments to be made about upholding the status quo and whatever else. But from a baseline standpoint, superheroes are good guys. And then once you get past that and you grow out of that, you want to read the stories about, like, no, but superheroes have problems.
Yeah.
And sometimes, for some people, that's Watchmen. And for a later generation, that was Identity Crisis. And so I think because people had that working baseline from Justice League to work from, in some ways Identity Crisis was that next logical step. But I think Identity Crisis also fails those readers.
Yeah, no, I think, honestly, I feel like Watchmen probably fails those readers, too, in a lot of ways. Identity Crisis fails them in every way, I would say.
If you told me Identity Crisis introduced people to the concept of superheroes, those people would have an immensely fucked up idea of what a superhero is.
Yeah. And we could, like, we could list off stories that we thought were good that are also, like, comics that I would fail that reader in those terms. Like, Final Crisis, like, it's not your first comic. I mean, like, it can't be.
Kraven's Last Hunt, which I will go to bat for, is a great story, should not be your first Spider-Man story.
No, absolutely not. Like, there's an illusory sense of quality that you get from things that are adult in nature. A thing that is about this subject is good, whereas a thing that is about gorillas is bad, is lowbrow. It's the highbrow-lowbrow divide. Identity Crisis is a story with themes and with events that are coded as highbrow because they are serious, in quotes, things. So it's easy to be fooled into thinking, Superman crying? That's new? Like, that's this must be serious. Whereas those of us who've been in the shit for 30 years are like, yeah, there was a time when all Superman did was cry. He could cry it and use heat vision. Those were his two fucking powers. Like, and I feel like I've heard from a lot of people who know, like, obviously I'm not quiet about it, but they know about my opinions of Identity Crisis, and they'll be like, yeah, like, my first comic was Identity Crisis, and I'm surprised I stuck around and, like, learned about other things. Like, now I look back on it, and, you know, somebody told me, like, yeah, I'm, like, really ashamed that Identity Crisis was my favorite comic. And like, don't be. Don't ever be ashamed that you used to like a bad thing, because if you used to like a bad thing that you don't like anymore, that means you learned. Like, that means you found a better thing to like.
Well, it means you read more. It means you read more and you're like, oh, wait, no, this is good.
Yeah, and honestly, it means something in Identity Crisis worked. It means that you wanted to learn more about that DC universe or about this medium, even.
Here's what I can give Identity Crisis. You could read Identity Crisis as your first comic and come away with it with this question. Why do these characters hate each other so much? And that can be your in to reading more and finding out, I guess. You might not actually get the answer to that question, but it raises a question. All right, are we done? Have we gotten it all out of our system?
Okay. We've said a lot of stuff. We haven't said how you explain that to a person. And you don't. You can't. Like,
yeah, the answer is you
can't. Because nobody's going to listen to you tell them, hey, that thing you like, it's actually bad. Like, even if it is, you can't do it. Like, you can say, well, I don't like it because I think it's inappropriate for that story to introduce those themes into stuff that had already been published. Like, you can't, like, Dr. Light, you can't use anymore without this context. Like, you have to put him away for 20 years. You know, like, and I don't think that's good storytelling. I don't think it's good storytelling to leave a character in a worse place than you found him. You can explain that, but you can't tell them it's bad. Because they're not gonna, because they're just gonna be like, yeah, well, I like it. And you know what? If they like it, that's fine. I like trash garbage sometimes.
There's things that are bad that I love. I think you have to come to, like, what you have to say is, look, Identity Crisis just doesn't fit my personal preference for what a superhero is or should be. And to you, that might be why that it's an interesting story to you, because it's different. It breaks that mold. But for me, I want superhero stories to be about people who aren't terrible. That's that's what it boils down to.
And please note that we will never take this advice ourselves. Because we are the arbiters of truth. And that does it. That does it for War Rocket Ajax number 336. Before we go, one of the things that we want to do going forward here on War Rocket Ajax is at the end of the show, we want to highlight a charitable organization or someone that's doing good work in our community that we can all get behind. And I mentioned earlier in the show, when I was talking about being on the People v. Batman v. Superman, that I did that in exchange for a donation to the Durham Crisis Response Center, DCRC. And that is an organization that Aiden, my fiance volunteers for, so I thought you might want to tell the people about DCRC, sweetheart.
I can, yeah, absolutely. Hi, guys. I've been involved with DCRC since October. I got involved right away when we moved here. DCRC is kind of is the Durham iteration of what everyone probably has in their own town. We work with sexual violence and domestic violence survivors, with a whole bunch of different things. There's a crisis line that people can call 24/7. There's a hospital response, so there's people who actually go to hospitals and, you know, advocate for, you know, sexual and domestic violence survivors. There's court advocacy, which is what I do. And there's also like a charity shop, and there's a whole bunch of other stuff. I really, really love DCRC, but there's DCRCs everywhere. When we were in Sumter, I worked with STSM, Sexual Trauma Services of the Midlands. So if you want to give money to DCRC, that's awesome, but really, like, you should just get involved with your own domestic violence charity in your own hometown.
Yeah, this is really something where it really pays off to act locally.
Look, the internet is a horror show. I deleted Twitter off my phone because I couldn't look at it first thing in the morning, because it's like the inside of my anxiety brain projected on the world. It's just like constant just bad news and, like, no real action plan. It's all, like, really big news you can't do anything with. Going and volunteering with an organization, it's really grounding, and it's really fulfilling in a way that just, like, being upset online will never be, you know? If you're really, like, you know, if you're really upset and you don't know what to do beyond, you know, calling your representatives, which, you know, if you live in North Carolina, like we all do, that's kind of a crapshoot. Actually getting involved and actually, like, talking with people and actually helping people in a tangible way is really, really effective, not only on a community building level, but also on, like, a spiritual level and on a personal level. I feel so much better, you know, going and after a shift.
Yeah. So if you, are in our area, you can find the Durham Crisis Response Center at durhamcrisisresponse.org, and you can make a donation. And if you enjoyed my appearance on the People v. Batman v. Superman, that was the charity that I was appearing for. If you're not in the area and you want to do something similar, I can guarantee you there's an organization that is in your area doing similar work, and you found them just by Googling.
Yeah, right? I just Googled. So. I got into this work because I used volunteermatch.com. When we were living in South Carolina, I was looking for women's issues, and the three things that came up were working with the elderly, trying to, an anti-abortion organization, and STSM. So my options were limited. But I guarantee if you just Google, like, your town or your area, you know, when we lived in Sumter, STSM was the area, was the rural area we were living in.
Yeah.
So just Google it, search for it. Or, you know, and if domestic violence is not your deal, that's fine. You know, find your thing. It's, you know, it's fine. You know, whatever is going to get you through the next few years is so important.
Right. Well, thank you, honey. And again, you can check that out at durhamcrisisresponse.org.
Thank you, Aiden, for coming by and telling us all about DCRC. Look up your own town's organization that does similar things. Here in Asheville, it's called Our Voice. You can Google it very easily and find it. If you would like to send us a listener question, and every story ever list, or a panel president list, you could do so by emailing us at warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. You can also let us know if you want to sponsor the show there. Be sure to check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. It's where you can stream the show, download the show, read show notes, and leave comments. It's also where you can find the panel president and every story ever lists. Check us out on iTunes. If you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes. The more positive reviews we get, the more we are featured there. Now we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us on the internet. For me, I've made this very simple. All you have to do is go to mattdwilson.net, and you will find links to all my stuff. Sometime in the very near future, you will find a link to pre-order my new book coming out in June, Supreme Villainy. Chris, where can everybody find your stuff?
Everybody can find my stuff by going to the-isb.com. That has links to the comics I write, the columns I write, and the podcasts that I do, including this one, which you don't need to find, but maybe you need to find Movie Fighters or Sailor Business or Xena Warrior Business, all of which have brand new episodes. Sailor Business just hit 100 episodes, so we are halfway through the series. So thanks everybody who is a crossover listener to that. I will not be back next week, but Matt, you're going to be back next week with a guest host and a great guest for the second proper episode of War Rocket Ajax of 2017. As for me, I'll catch your ass on the high seas.
Yes! Flash. From this day on.
In the first week of what I have christened the 2016 Cheerwine Throwdown, which is what I'm existing in right now.
You mean 2017?
Yep, that's what I mean. The other thing that I have to check in with, doing a take two real quick.